Hey, it's Craig. I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to Canadian History X early and ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime. Greetings and welcome to another episode of Canadian History X. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can for as little as $3 a month. Just go to patreon.com/CanadaEHX. You can also donate to the podcast by going to CanadaEHX.com and clicking Donate. Don't forget, I have two other podcasts out there, Pucks and Cups, and From John to Justin, available on all podcast platforms. Today I'm talking with Crawford Killian, who wrote the book Go Do Some Great Thing. It's a book about the black pioneers who settled in British Columbia, and the various things that they did to help shape the future province. There's some really interesting characters, some amazing stories, and I really recommend this book. So let's get right to the interview. What kind of inspired you to write Go Do Some Great Thing?
Well, I was looking around for possible episodes in BC history that I might write a children's textbook on, and because I'd done one or two of those before, and I ran across just a throwaway mention of the black pioneers in BC in a standard history of the province. And I sort of thought, wait, what? Black people up in BC? This was in the mid-1970s, okay? And one didn't see very many black people here. So I dug into it, and the more I dug, the better the story got and the more amazing the people were. And finally, I decided there had to be a straight nonfiction book here. And a local publisher expressed interest, and we were off to the races. So that was 42 years ago when it first came out.
Why do you feel we don't know enough about the black pioneers of British Columbia?
I think it was mostly just a matter of, first of all, forgetting our own past. Or relegating it to, a few old guys with funny beards and old-fashioned clothes, you know, who supposedly did something a long time ago. We just don't think much about historical perspectives. But when you get into it, when you see how... I should explain this, first of all. The Crown Colony of Vancouver Island, as it was in 1858, was administratively separate from the mainland, which didn't become part of the province of British Columbia until a little later. The colony knew that it was sort of responsible for what was going on the mainland, and the governor, Sir James Douglas, knew that gold had been discovered along the Fraser. And he knew that meant Americans would be flooding up from California in huge numbers pretty soon. And he had a couple of hundred Europeans, and that was it, in Victoria, and scattered up and down the island. You know, and he had seen in his own career the Americans move from east to west all the way to the Pacific Ocean and just take over everything they came to. And he could well imagine that was going to happen to him. So he needed some kind of ballast, some kind of counterweight to the Americans he knew he would be getting. And there was no way he'd get enough British subjects, you know, in place in any good time. But here was a community of black people in San Francisco, and the Supreme Court itself had just declared that they could never be American citizens. Even if they had been born free. So he figured, okay, these people will have to do. And he invited them to come up and take a look around. They sent a committee up. The committee reported back, this is a great place, a God-sent land for the colored man. And about 600 to 800 people migrated up the coast in the spring and summer of 1858. And they formed a sizable proportion of the colony's population. That made them important right there. The Americans who came up with them and during that whole period tended to flow through Victoria. They would stop there, rest up, buy supplies and head over to the mainland to look for gold. Most of the black population stayed put, and they had jobs, they opened businesses, they were very active in the local community. So they provided Douglas with the ballast he needed. And I think in the long run, it helped a lot. But after the Civil War, many of the black pioneers figured, well, we didn't get everything we were really promised here. And now Reconstruction is going on in the States. We can go back and have, you know, proper lives as American citizens. So they left, and just a small number of black remained in British Columbia. And they became a regularly smaller proportion of the population, never seen as a threat to the majority whites. That, you know, there was a lot of racism aimed at the Chinese and the Japanese, but not so much to the black population. So they were essentially just forgotten.
One of the more interesting parts of the book I found was the story of Salt Spring Island and the impact that the black pioneers had on the island. Was the research of stuff like that, was it difficult at times?
Was it difficult to find the material?
Yeah, to do the research to find, you know, the story of these people.
There's quite a bit of material there on the settlers. And Salt Spring was a kind of Plan B. The governor in Victoria could see that a lot of people were coming back broke from the gold fields. They just hadn't made their fortune, and they didn't have enough money to get home. So they decided, let's settle some of these people on Salt Spring, and they can form a little kind of farm community to supply the Victoria with vegetables and so on, livestock. And some blacks were among the first people just to settle on the island under what was called preemption. You could take over a piece of crown land, and as long as you stayed on it and you improved it, in 5 years it was yours. And so the black settlers got some of the best land on the island, and were followed by others. There was then a terrible winter in 1861-62, which drove out many of the settlers, but the blacks stayed put, even though it was pretty tough. And they ended up, as a result, doing pretty well. They then found that some people wanted their land, and there were a couple of very mysterious murders of black settlers that seemed to be aimed at getting possession of their particular land. But there were also some remarkable families like the Starks, who settled on the island, raised a family, and Sylvia Stark, who arrived as a very pregnant young mother with two toddlers already, ended up dying at, I think it was 106 in 1944. And she was just the matriarch of the island. Something else that was kind of interesting about Salt Spring was that it never worked out as a kind of a farm colony for Victoria. It was almost a kind of proto-hippie settlement where the people who settled there were quite happy to stay at subsistence farm levels, most of them. Some did better, obviously, but they just wanted to be left alone. And I suspect that the black settlers were among them. You know, they took care of themselves. They were very tough and resilient and resourceful, but they were not much interested in the rest of the province or the rest of the world.
Speaking of some of the people, you mentioned a couple, but people like Mifflin Wistar Gibbs, were there other people who kind of really stood out for you as kind of notable characters in the tale of the Black Pioneers?
Well, certainly Mifflin Gibbs was the most notable of them. He had come up a little late in June of 1858 and immediately began making a fortune. He opened up the first store that ever competed with the Hudson's Bay Company, which had owned all of Western, you know, Canada for a long time. And then he began to invest in real estate, and he did extremely well there. He ended up, among other things, building a coal mine and a tramway on Haida Gwaii to provide coal for Victoria. And he was the first black elected city council member in Victoria. And he then left the province, went back to the States, and became a judge in Little Rock, Arkansas, a banker, and a diplomat. He was sent in his 70s to Madagascar as a U.S. consul. And he put up with that for a couple of years and then excused himself. That was quite enough for an old guy. So he was a remarkable man. But there were others. There were the Jones brothers, for example, who had all been brought up in Oberlin, Ohio. Their father, a blacksmith, had seen them all through Oberlin College, which was the only school in North America then that accepted black students. And three of the brothers had come to British Columbia. Two became very prominent miners in Barkerville. One also had a sideline as a dentist. He was known as Painless Jones. And meanwhile, another brother settled on Salt Spring and taught the kids on the island free, for, you know, at no cost and without being paid for about 5 years before the settlers finally shamed the provincial government into paying him something, because he'd been tramping up and down the island for those years, you know, just to provide some sort of education for the kids. So there were some very remarkable people indeed in the among the black pioneers.
One of the stories I really enjoyed was when you were talking about the black pioneers being a political force and Gibbs running for city council and Osmose de Cosmos running against him and the things that he did to try and make sure that Gibbs was not elected. What kind of force were the black pioneers towards politics in early, especially obviously Victoria?
Sir James Douglas had promised them that if they stayed for, I think, 3 years or something, and became property owners, they could have the vote, which was a huge attraction for them. But when it finally came to it, and the Colonial Council was up for election, it was a little problematic whether all the blacks who voted were entirely qualified to. And they were very pro-Douglas, as you might imagine. And Amor de Cosmos, who was then a newspaper editor and would later become the premier, was very much in the reform faction, who thought old square toes James Douglas was a hopeless reactionary and would really have to be replaced with some more go-ahead types. So de Cosmos and the black community kind of got in each other's way, and de Cosmos got pretty nasty about it in his newspaper, and Mifflin Gibbs wrote back and gave him as good as he got. And it was quite a kerfuffle. But you have to understand, in those days also, it was an open ballot. Mm-hmm. You marched in and you told the returning officer who you were casting your vote for. And everyone was keeping track, and they would go out and roust out somebody else if the race was getting close, come and vote for so-and-so, and so forth. So it was a bit of an uproar, and it did cause some ill feeling, I think, on both sides.
And then looking at, obviously, when we look at black pioneers coming up, we tend to obviously realize that there was racism, but they didn't face as much as they did in the United States. But in your book, one of the kind of most telling aspects of the racism was the issue over the church and the integration of the church.
This was fairly early on, and it was kind of typical of the sort of passive-aggressive racism that the blacks encountered here, as opposed to the straight in your face, we hate you. they got in the U.S. So they were, you know, they were technically welcome and so forth. And there was certainly no segregation in housing. People lived where they could afford, and you know, blacks, whites, Chinese were all living on the same street, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But they very much wanted to avoid setting up their own church. They wanted to have integrated religious services. Some of the local churches turned them away. One did not, but some of the parishioners, some of the white parishioners, complained about having the blacks in the same pews with them and so on. Mm-hmm. So that turned into quite a kerfuffle. It was finally sorted out, but no one was very happy with the result. You know, the church did not do very well, and the black pioneers kind of drifted off to other churches. In some cases, when they moved out of Victoria into Saanich, for example, they did build churches, but they again were integrated ones. Mm-hmm. You know, all the settlers in the Saanich neighborhood would attend that church.
And can you talk a bit about the all black militia unit that kind of served as like the only line of defense for Victoria at times?
Yes, it was. It was in some ways a reaction to the fact that Victoria had formed a volunteer fire department, and they excluded blacks. It was whites only. So the blacks said, all right, let's form a militia, because there was no real defense for the colony. There was a few Royal Navy Marines, you know, there was a naval base at Esquimalt, but it was nothing like, a real fortress. And so they decided, with the governor's blessing, that they would start this militia unit. And they hired a Marine sergeant from the Navy to drill them. And they got uniforms. They looked as professional as any other 1860s North American military unit. They carried on for a couple of years. But when Douglas left and the new governor came in, there was going to be a parade to welcome him, of various, you know, community groups and so on. And the African Rifles wanted to join and were told, no, you can't. And they had also been pretty effectively kept from training with serious rifles. So that was a bit of a drawback too. So the African Rifles eventually disbanded, simply because there was no more official support for them. Still, they were there, and they were quite prepared when there was some friction between the U.S. and Britain over what was called the Pig War on San Juan Island. Mm-hmm. They were prepared to stand up to, the American army if it should invade. It would have been quite a fight.
It would have been, absolutely. For people reading the book, what do you hope they get out of learning about the history of the Black Pioneers?
I hope they can see that, first of all, they were remarkable people. You know, mm-hmm. to have come 3,000 miles, some of them, across the United States and be hated on sight by every white person who saw them, practically. Mm-hmm. And still to get to the West Coast and then to come up to a new country and do as well as they did was a pretty remarkable achievement, and it called for a lot of skill and brains and character. So that was part of it. Also, I think they did play a key part in not only preserving Western Canada for Canada. Mifflin Gibbs was one of the, you might call him a sort of a stepfather of Confederation, because he was in the Yale Convention, which was a political meeting that hammered out the terms under which British Columbia would join the Confederation. which happened in 1871, you know, 4 years after the original Confederation. So he had a say in that, and that was important. So they were there. They helped form the foundations for BC and therefore for Canada. And then they carried on, and the ones who stayed kind of got on with their lives. They put up with some discrimination for sure, but to a great extent, they could simply carry on and live fairly ordinary lives. Mm-hmm.
I hope you enjoyed that interview, and if you did, please leave a rating and review. If you like, you can reach me through email at craig@canadaehx.com. You can also visit my website, where you'll find hundreds of articles on Canada's history, as well as all my podcast episodes. Just go to CanadaEHX.com. And don't forget, you can support the podcast through Patreon. There are multiple tiers to choose from, all with great benefits. You can support the podcast for as little as $3 a month, just like all of these wonderful patrons have, and I apologize if I mispronounce any names. Randy McCallum, Diane Wade, Lorianne Kirby, Gary Dolovich, Nick Zinri, Shannon Marshall, Clinton Martinez, Dimitri Chauve, Aaron O'Hara Myers, Robert Dunseith, Todd Casey, Catherine Roa, Luke S., J.P. Baer, Jason Hall, Phil Maynard, and Iris Gray. If you want, you can find me on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/CanadianHistoryX. You can find me on Twitter. My handle is Craig Baird, CraigBaird. And you can find me on Instagram. Just go to Bairdo37. Thanks, and we'll see you again next time.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his 6-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his 2-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.